It's 4:06. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after national policy changes, some veterans in Milwaukee and Madison are still waiting longer for care than the VA's timeliness standard mandates.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Oshinsky. Wisconsin held elections this week, two of which had to do with the state Supreme Court. We'll talk about the results, as well as Shirley Abrahamson's legal challenge to keep her spot as Chief Justice.
A state agency made news this week when it voted to ban employees from working on climate change while on the job. We'll cover what happened and the perception of that.
Finally, the DNR is considering changes to its science bureau and may dissolve that group entirely.
For more on those stories, WPR's assistant news director Noah Oshinsky joins us in the studio. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here as always, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Well, looking back to Tuesday, election results, not the most marquee of elections we've ever seen here in Wisconsin, but a couple of statewide issues on the ballot.
Absolutely. Low-key, but races of consequence nonetheless. Two big races, and both involve the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, the incumbent and member of the liberal wing on the court, ran against Rock County Judge James Daly. Bradley won convincingly. Whether it's a landslide or not, I'll leave that up to you, but won convincingly with 58% of the vote to Daly's 42%. This is Bradley, actually, in her acceptance speech, talking about how her vision for an independent court, one free from special interests, led to this win.
There are those who would trade away the public trust and confidence in our courts, the very trust and confidence that gives us our legitimacy. To them, I say, not in our system of justice.
So the incumbent, Bradley, reelected. Does this change much of anything on the court itself?
Not really. It doesn't really alter things too much. Conservative justices still hold a majority on the court. These races are technically nonpartisan, but many times the actual rulings and races end up being, you know, made or decided along political philosophies. I suppose Bradley's election means that, you know, there could be at least one more dissenting opinion in some politically charged cases. Other than that, not much of a change.
Yeah, we didn't see the barrage of ads we've seen in past ones. And in part, maybe that's because no matter what happened, that majority was going to be there. 4-3 or 5-2 maybe wasn't as worth people getting invested in.
Exactly. It wasn't all that consequential when you look at the different ways elections can affect the Supreme Court.
And then another statewide, not a race exactly, a ballot item.
Right. So this was a constitutional amendment that changes the way the chief judge is selected on the court. Right now, the longest serving justice is the chief. So it's established by seniority. The amendment, which passed 53% to 47%, turns the decision making over to the court itself. The court will now be able to select their chief.
As you mentioned, these statewide court races tend to have a partisan political angle on them, even though they're nonpartisan. What was the partisan or political backdrop here?
Not officially, but the question, you know, in reality, it really was kind of partisan because Republican lawmakers added it to the ballot. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business group, spent over $500,000 promoting it. So there certainly was a partisan edge to the question.
So this could mean an actual change on the court.
Yeah, absolutely. It could mean that Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who is the current chief and considered a liberal, will likely be replaced by a member of the court's conservative majority.
Story's not quite over yet, though. Some developments later in the week.
Right, exactly. So Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson filed a lawsuit in an effort to keep that title, actually, until the end of her term later on in the decade. She argues that was the assumption, essentially, that voters made when they reelected her in 2009, that they were not only reelecting her, but also her in that role. So we'll see what happens with that lawsuit.
And what is the latest development? I know there's a road ahead for that suit.
Right. So federal judge declined to issue a preliminary injunction, which would have prevented the court from taking steps to implement that change. So, you know, they can't technically stop it from being, you know, from the court actually taking up this change. But the court in the case said that he wasn't really deciding on the merits of the case. He just said that he thinks it can be resolved quick enough so that, you know, no injunction was needed. A hearing is actually set for April 21st.
Okay, we'll watch to see what happens there and what the court actually does afterward. Now, the DNR, it's been in the news thanks in part to Governor Walker's budget, but there was more core to the story, it turned out this week.
Right. So this was a report by Ron Seely at the Center for Investigative Journalism. And he's reporting this week that the DNR is considering dissolving the Bureau of Science Services. Now, for a little background, this is actually a division made up mostly of scientists that supply the data, the research, that helps inform the policies of the DNR, other state agencies, as well as the work of, you know, various nonprofit groups around the state.
So what happens then under this concept of ending that particular department?
Right. So the agency is looking at least dissolving the division and redistributing the researchers throughout the entirety of the DNR. Officials aren't commenting specifically about the possible changes. When asked previously, though, about sort of the DNR's, you know, commitment to research, officials there have said that science will remain part of the decision-making process.
And Governor Walker's budget proposal included some cuts to the DNR, including some of the positions that would be affected here.
More than a dozen positions are being proposed to be cut in that division alone. And that's aside from this potential plan to dissolve it.
Okay, now, DNR, a lot of people have political views here. What's been the response? Is there criticism already to this?
Yeah, absolutely. Critics, both inside and outside of the agency. Ron Seely quoted an unnamed DNR manager who said the change would, quote, destroy the independence and credibility of scientific research within the agency. George Meyer, former DNR secretary and current executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, said the change would actually undermine the DNR's credibility with an organization, you know, like his, that he belongs to.
So where does this go now?
Stay tuned. You know, the ongoing budget process and this proposed change are, you know, closely linked. So I'd guess that there may be some news to report on this front probably in the coming weeks, if not months.
All right. And now another environment-related story. And this one, some people have been making a big deal out of on social media on climate change in the state.
Right. So this is a story that went national. And what happened is the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, which is a tiny agency by state government standards, voted 2-1 to prohibit staff from working on climate change issues while on the clock. And just as a reminder, this is sort of an agency we don't talk a lot about in the news, but it manages various state assets, which includes public land, and that's primarily forests in northern Wisconsin.
So why did this issue come up?
Well, two members of the board, both Republicans, voted in favor of this policy. Both say it's an effort to prevent staff from working on things they don't see as part of the agency's mission. The members include Attorney General Brad Schimmel and State Treasurer Matt Adamczyk.
And then that was a 2-1 vote. Who dissented?
The dissenting vote was Secretary of State Doug LaFollette. He argues that the issue of climate change is in fact relevant to the agency's mission, given that they, you know, manage forests and that forests, in fact, are affected by climate change. He also says the policy change was aimed specifically at Tia Nelson, the board's executive secretary. If that name sounds familiar, it should. She is the daughter of Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day.
So a small state agency, you said, it's those guys elected to those statewide positions that aren't governor. Why is this getting the attention it is, do you think?
Well, you know, I'll leave it to the listener to decide how big of a deal it is, but it is representative of this sort of ongoing debate or divide we have in this country over whether climate change is real, and if so, what is causing it, and in this case, how that debate influences what government does or does not do.
All right, Noah, thanks as always for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovchinsky covering some of the biggest news from around the state for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Last August, Congress passed the Veterans Access, Choice, and Accountability Act after news surfaced of long delays in some VA centers around the country. The law provided more money to VA centers and allows veterans to seek care outside of the system if wait times will be longer than 30 days.
Since that law has passed, the Associated Press has been investigating wait times at VA centers around the country and found that while hospitals in Wisconsin fare well overall, waits in Milwaukee and Madison are longer than the national average and could be growing. Here with us now is Dana Ferguson, an AP reporter based in Madison. Dana, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start right here in Wisconsin. What did you find about wait times here in VA centers?
Sure. So as you said, in Wisconsin, hospitals, clinics seem to be faring a little bit better than the national average. VA hospitals across the country have seen sort of a national average of 2.8% of appointments that occur after 31 days or more. And Wisconsin is doing better than that overall, with 1.4% of appointments across the state occurring after about a month. And as you said, Madison and Milwaukee facilities are seeing longer wait times because they are larger facilities. But overall, Wisconsin's doing pretty well.
Now, that 1.4% here in Wisconsin, does that represent an improvement?
It's hard to say. You know, this data that we're looking at hasn't necessarily been looked at before. AP picked it up after August when that act went into effect. So it's hard to really make a comparison at this point.
Well, the AP looked at VA hospitals, as you said, nationally. Did you pick up on any overarching trends from that national big picture?
I think there are definitely pockets across the country that are seeing longer wait times. In the South, there are quite a few of those. But looking at Wisconsin as compared to those pockets, we're definitely not seeing any huge waits. So that's good for Wisconsinites. But yes, there are pockets, but it seems that over that expanse of time, hospitals are doing better, the VA hospitals. Yeah. Can I say anything more about that? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. We'll leave that that point there. But overall, so it sounds like it's fair to say the new funds and the policy implemented last year have made a difference. Is that a fair statement?
I think it sort of depends where you're looking, but it would seem that in Wisconsin that could be true.
Now, the VA in Toma, Wisconsin, has been in the spotlight in recent months for overprescribing opioids. Now, in general, do you have a sense how the VA system in Wisconsin compares with other states?
I don't know that I'm quite understanding the question you're asking there.
Just looking at some of the troubles Wisconsin has had recently, it's been in the news. Do other states seem to be experiencing some issues along similar lines or other hiccups in the service to vets?
Sure. I think other states are seeing some of the same issues, definitely with opiate prescription. There are programs out there that are making an effort to reduce the amount of opiates that are being prescribed at hospitals across the country. And Wisconsin doesn't seem to be having the same issues with wait times. But as you mentioned, the facility in Toma has definitely come into the national spotlight recently for alleged opiate overprescription, for retaliatory behaviors among staff. And after a hearing last week, it sounds like those issues are not solely occurring at that Toma facility.
And do you know which facilities in the state had the lowest wait times, where the wait time was the lowest?
Sure, yeah. So the data shows that Kenosha and Chippewa Falls clinics seem to have the lowest wait times. They reported about 0.3% of the appointments that occurred there happened after about a month or more, and that's very low, again, compared to the national average of 2.8%. So those were the clinics that we showed as having very, very minimal numbers of patients coming in after having to wait.
No, so it was good to get a picture of why a success story happens. Do we have a handle on why the wait times were low there?
We don't necessarily have as much an idea of why they were doing sort of better. We have ideas as to why some of the other clinics were not putting up the same low wait times. We know that facilities that had the longer wait times had lost physicians or were just dealing with higher patient loads. So I think it could be fairly said that maybe they were operating at full staff, had enough physicians to see their patients, or maybe they didn't have as many patients at those smaller clinics.
Now, taking a look at places in Wisconsin with longer waits. Madison and Milwaukee, a bit of a different story here. Now, you actually found that there was an increase in the number of veterans waiting more than 30 days. How significant was that increase?
That is correct. At those facilities, at least in Milwaukee, our early data from September showed that they had 187 appointments that took longer than 2 months to complete. So those patients were waiting more than 2 months to see a doctor. And by February, that number had more than doubled. So 455 patients out in Milwaukee waited more than 2 months to see a doctor there. And in speaking with some of the spokesmen who work out there, it sounds like they are really having a lack of providers. So it's become difficult for them to meet the demand they're seeing. But they said that they're really working to make sure that anyone waiting more than 30 days gets a chance to see a non-VA doctor or find another option so that if they're having a serious problem, it's being taken care of.
We're talking right now with Dana Ferguson, an AP reporter based in Madison, taking a look at wait times in Wisconsin when it comes to VA centers. The AP looked at VA centers in Wisconsin and around the country. In general, wait times down in Wisconsin, but Madison and Milwaukee, a bit of a different story with longer wait times. And Dana, you said there was perhaps a lack of providers that was contributing to these longer wait times in Madison and also in Milwaukee. Any sense about why that is, why there is a shortage of providers in those two locations?
You know, of that, I am not sure. The spokesman I talked to didn't really seem to have an answer to that either. At some clinics, doctors are retiring or just leaving those positions, and whenever there's a hole, these spokesmen are saying it's difficult to fill it right away, which can leave a gap then for patients in getting their immediate service. But no definite answer as to why these physicians are not filling those spots.
Now, the new law allows veterans to look for care somewhere else if they have to wait more than 30 days. So in the case of Milwaukee, of Madison, where that is happening, we're seeing these trends of wait times going up. Are veterans looking for care somewhere else?
Yes, it sounds like, based on the conversations that I've had, that people are looking outside the VA system if they have problems that really need immediate attention. But there are other veterans who are just taking the time to wait. They might feel comfortable in the VA system, and if they have something that is not urgent or pressing, they would be likely to just wait the month or so until they're able to see their VA physician.
Are there particular areas of medicine that might put veterans on a longer waiting list, either in Milwaukee and Madison or elsewhere?
Yeah, just looking at, I mean, the Green Bay facility, they just recently had an audiologist transfer. They've had a surgeon resign. And so in those areas, they've really been having trouble getting patients in to see people in those areas right away. And they've been using the CHOICE program quite a bit to allow veterans to go outside the VA system to get health care or having them go to other VA hospitals across the state.
Now, as you mentioned, you spoke with hospital administrators, spokespeople. Did you get the sense that the wait times in Milwaukee and Madison are seen as a big problem or as, you know, maybe more of a temporary hurdle?
You know, it doesn't sound like, based on conversations with veterans advocates, that veterans are really struggling with these wait times. I spoke with Jim Duff, who's the director of the Milwaukee County Veterans Service Office, and he said he's really not hearing complaints about these wait times, that they've had good interactions with the VA hospital out in Milwaukee. So I think it might be more of a hurdle as far as they see it.
Is there any legislation that you know of that might be in the works, either on the federal side or the state side, that might be looking to address, you know, some of the areas where there is still a problem with wait times in Wisconsin or elsewhere in the country?
You know, as far as I know, there is not, but that could very easily change, especially as more people read this story or others around the country that looks at the same data that we've compiled.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
That was Dana Ferguson, AP reporter based in Madison, talking about wait times at Wisconsin's VA hospitals, also taking a bigger look at the national picture.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
As the weather warms up, a lot of us might be thinking about getting going on that spring cleaning. Our next guest says part of that cleaning should involve getting rid of stuff, and that gets more important as we get older. She makes the case that aging is a whole lot easier if we start downsizing our lives in advance.
Barbara McVicker is with us now. She's an elder care expert, an author, and creator of the public television special Stuck in the Middle, Caring for Mom and Dad. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Barbara, first of all, can you make the case why as people as they age should start to think about downsizing? What are the benefits?
The benefits of downsizing is just to have fewer things to kind of clutter and take away our energy. And particularly for those baby boomers like I am, where I have a house that was raising kids and have a second floor master bedroom and bathrooms that have very narrow doorways, you put that all together, and out of safety and out of just having a smaller footprint, it makes sense to start to downsize.
And often you hear about, you know, it's easier to make the move to a new living situation, you know, in a transition time as a senior. And sometimes you hear about kids having to deal with stuff after the parent is gone. Is that part of the case you make to people for downsizing?
Oh, I think always. I think that we do our families a disservice by not having crucial conversations, getting our documents together, downsizing when we are still able to do it ourselves. I really don't want to do this to my kids, partly because my parents did it to me and I had to do all the downsizing for them. I had to help them move. So I think we people that have been caregivers have said, we're going to do this earlier, we're going to do it on our terms, and we're not going to make our kids get stuck with this.
It's a wonderful idea, but do you think a lot of people get to that point and they just somehow find it hard to follow through and actually look through things, years of accumulated memories and objects, and actually get rid of stuff?
Yes. There's the emotional side of downsizing, which is, oh my gosh, I love all this stuff and nobody's going to want my dining room table and my kids don't want my old rocking chair or whatever. So yes, there's that emotional side, but there's the intellectual side of knowing that it makes sense to downsize, to declutter. And partly it's just out of the safety standpoint. When you have a lot of stuff around, you can trip over it. You can have things go wrong. You can have the rugs that are going to trip you. And so to declutter and get things out of the way is one of the nicest gifts we can give to the rest of our family. I think you need a system, though. And if you're just starting out looking at the whole big mess, you're like, this is overwhelming. When I cleaned out my parents' house, they had 30 consecutive years of National Geographic. And they also, when I went to the basement, I found a box marked pencils, too small to use. You know, our kids, these millennials, they don't want our collections. It's time that we stop kind of deluding ourselves and going, oh, I'm certain Johnny's going to want the train set from when he was 12. Well, no, they really don't. They're a mean lean, and they're ready to move at a moment's notice. And it's time that we kind of quit deluding ourselves that somebody's going to want all of our stuff.
Well, Barbara, we'll dig into the practical side of things in a minute, but I know a lot of what you do, not just on this downsizing issue, but you help people figure out how to start the conversation about, you know, legal or medical or other issues of aging. How about this one? How does, say, a spouse start this conversation with a spouse, maybe a pair of baby boomers, or that millennial kid you talked about? How do they bring this up with parents who might not be pondering this issue yet?
I think whenever you do anything out of love and safety, it's an okay topic, and you need to kind of say, we want to be able to carry out your wishes. We want to make certain that you have told us through documents what you want at end of life, how you want your assets dispersed, and part of that is also moving to a place where you can age in place. And instead, we try to do these tiny little baby steps where, okay, we'll retrofit the bathroom or something like that. And at some point, it just makes sense maybe to just make a move to a smaller place. And we would like to help you do that, Mom and Dad. Let's go out and look at places. Have you thought about what you might want to do in the future? Let's start those conversations now. I talk about the fact that I really think that we need to do these when the adult children are 40 and the parents are 70. That those conversations, those how do things look, what in the future, what do you envision, where will you be living, what will you be doing, and transition straight into it. Of course, housing is going to be a big factor.
We're talking right now with elder care expert Barbara McVicker. She's the author and creator of the public TV special Stuck in the Middle, Caring for Mom and Dad. She's making the case that as parents age, it's time to clean things out, downsize, and think of it as a gift for the next generation. And we go to our phone lines now. Jackie is with us from Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, yes. You know, I think the more clutter we have, the less time we have because we're so frustrated by our clutter, and I think we're really selfish as parents if we don't start decluttering. So years ago when I moved, I got rid of a beautiful set of china, a blue willow or something, and I got rid of my other china, and I just have happy plates, about 12 plates that don't match, but they're just happy. So if I die, they could be thrown away. And I'm an avid cyclist, still at 74. So I took my silver in and changed it, got it into money, and bought a bike. Mm. And I feel all the stuff I have in my house not important, you know, so if something does happen before I move, it could all just be taken to the Goodwill. But I know more people have more stuff. I've been with friends who have 3 and 4 sets of china. This next generation doesn't want all those things.
Mm. Oh, Jackie, I think you're so right, and I think because our parents handed stuff down to us, we kind of take it for granted that, oh, our kids are going to want our stuff or our collections. When you talk about a distraction, Jackie, the average person spends 55 minutes a day looking for things. Now, that's ridiculous. If we had fewer things and everything in its place, that wouldn't happen. The other thing that I think is interesting, it sounds like you're in kind of the age range where 50% of people over 50 say they have more than what they need. We don't need all that. It's time to reduce, reuse, recycle, and make a smaller footprint.
Thanks so much for that call, Jackie. Now, Barbara, you've gotten us motivated. You mentioned we need a system. Give us a starting point. How do we start this effort? We've got this house full of clutter. What do we do to start?
Yeah. I think the first thing you do is you set a date. And depending upon whether it's for yourself or whether it's for your parents, you might include other family members. Another thing is you might actually include a professional to help you do that. And then kind of work room by room. Assign tasks to everybody. Like, you're going to go through this, we'll go through that. I think the biggest thing is you should only touch everything once. When I was trying to help my parents downsize, they kept taking things out of boxes and touching them again. Or they'd say, oh, put it in the corner, we'll discuss it later. You cannot afford to do that. There's a point at which you touch it once and it goes to Goodwill, it goes to the grandkids, or it goes to the new place where you're moving. And I think for the elderly, one of the nice things is write down the stories. They have things that have a story to them. And write down what those stories are and attach them to the item that's maybe going to go to some other family member. And really, professional help is really quite helpful, whether it's appraising things so you know what's a collectible and what's junk. So having a professional come in maybe at the end or maybe to help you through the whole process. And as long as you're getting your stuff in order, make certain you get your documents in order, put them all together, let the whole family know where those documents are.
what about having the kids there with you? So just on the off chance there is a painting that has sentimental value for someone, something else, that it doesn't accidentally get tossed out because you're on a purging binge for the moment.
Well, I guess I'd feel the way that if we over-purge, maybe that's a good deal. I think we tend to under-purge, but that's why I think having somebody come in, if you really have some prized possessions that are worth something, have that person come in so you're not giving away something that really has some kind of monetary value. But I found it interesting when I downsized my parents, I then put on a whole list that we electronically sent around to the family members, and everybody got a turn, and then the next person got a turn, et cetera. And I put monetary value next to those things that really did have some monetary value, and then the rest just listed what they were. I was surprised. On the grandchildren, every one of them wanted something that had that sentimental value and could care less about the dollar value.
Now, can this this be an opportunity to share family history, the objects maybe trigger the story about great-grandma, you know, and then the memory you have is the story, the stuff itself. Okay, we can get rid of that now that we've talked about it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's easier, particularly for the elderly, to give things away to a human, you know. So I keep saying, you know, take something. Even if it's not what you want, if grandma or grandpa hands it to you, take it because now it's out of their house. But the other thing I did was those things that did go into our kids' houses, I took pictures of them and gave them to my parents so they saw that this has this new place in this loving home of their grandchild or in my home.
We're talking right now with elder care expert Barbara McVicker about downsizing as we age. And she says getting rid of stuff as we get older makes life easier for ourselves and for our adult children.
And we want to hear from you. Have you done something like this, gotten rid of a lot of material possessions? Have you gotten older? Or have you been in a position where you wish this downsizing had happened? Maybe an unexpected move for yourself or an aging parent, cleaning out the house, setting up an estate sale. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with elder care expert Barbara McVicker. She makes the case that we should downsize as we get older. She has advice on how to get it started and how to start the conversations, too.
And you can join us with your thoughts, your experiences at 800-642-1234. You may be in the process of getting rid of a lifetime worth of stuff. Does it make life easier to have less as you age? And do you find it hard to get rid of things that you feel an attachment to that you've had around you? Share your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to our callers. We've got Verge on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Verge, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, my husband's family has this, and I don't know whether they intended this to be a tradition, but it's become a tradition. When Grandpa died, Grandma downsized. And the family started out with just a family-only auction. And so if someone in the family wanted a particular thing, they could buy it. And then that money went to Grandma. And everything else then went into an auction the next day or the following weekend. When Grandma downsized the second time, we did the same thing. We had a big auction in her living room and sold off to all the family members. Cousins and aunts and uncles were bidding against each other, and we made a big party of it. And only blood relatives could bid on things. And then all the money from that then went to Grandma's care. And just recently, a few years ago, his mom then had this big auction as she was downsizing from her larger home. And again, you know, the kids got to bid against one another, and, you know, that was a public auction at that point. But I think an auction is a great way to go, and then all the proceeds go to the parents, and everybody gets what they want. So I would highly recommend doing something like that.
Verge, thank you so much. What a great story. Barbara, I think that would work well as long as you don't have a family with a really mean competitive streak, because otherwise that auction could get ugly, I think.
Well, ugly and maybe drive prices way up. I don't know.
But that just helps Grandma, so I guess that's good.
That's true, if it's going to go to Grandma. But what a great idea. And if they kind of made it fun and in a party, I think it's easier to get rid of your items when they do go to family members.
Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Ann in Baraboo. Ann, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we didn't have the luxury of being able to plan ahead with our parents. They died unexpectedly, first my father and then some years later my mother. But my sister came up with this great idea of there were three of us, and we could go through and choose what we wanted, taking turns, and then there were some things that we got rid of. We could all agree on that. And then this group of things that were in between, it was too hard to decide if we could part with them, but we didn't know if we really wanted to take them home. So my sister came up with the idea of putting the items in her basement in boxes, and then in 2 years we would go through them again, and anybody could keep what they wanted, and then we parted with the rest. And that just seemed a really good way to do it, because it was too much too soon to try and decide, you know, on things that you couldn't really say for sure if you wanted to get rid of them. But it gave us the time to kind of let things heal a bit and then be able to take a fresh look. And I took a few more things home, but then we were able to part with a lot.
Well, thank you for sharing your experience with us, Anne. Appreciate that. And that's an interesting take, because it is an emotional process, as Anne points out, getting rid of things that are associated with relationships and family and love. Sometimes you're not in a position to make that call right then. What about putting it in a box for a couple of years?
I think that that's an excellent idea. She's very fortunate that her sister says, hey, you can put all those boxes in my basement, because I think that that can work well if you actually stick by it and set a time and say, we're all going to come back and this will be the final go-through. I know of so many people as I speak across the country that say that they just said, we don't have time right now, or it's too emotional, and they got a storage unit. And 10 years later, they've never opened the storage unit. So I think I hear as many people saying, you know, it just didn't work well. We put it away and we never went back to it. And I've been paying, you know, $50 or $100 a month storing this stuff. So they sounded like they worked together as a team and it worked out well.
And thanks a lot for the call. Practical advice here from Peter on Facebook, who writes, a tablet or ebook reader can be a good tool for this. The ability to consolidate a shelf full of books to a small portable device that can adjust the font size, by the way, to a comfortable level is quite nice. That's a pretty good idea, Barbara.
Yeah, it is. I have tips that I send out every week, and this was the week, I think, that I was talking about how everybody thinks they have treasured possessions, just wonderful stuff. And then all of a sudden, at a baby boomers, you start to think, you know what? It's starting to feel like clutter. And then as you're going through it, and it seems to me like you're, you know, months have gone by, now it feels like time to trash it or get rid of it. And by the time my kids get to it, they're just going to back up a dump truck and drive it away. So somewhere along that line, we kind of need to intercede and do some getting rid of and deciding what is truly junk or what could do so well given to somebody else that could use it. One of the big questions always is, what do I use the most? And kind of put that in one box. And then what is it that doesn't work anymore? And more than that is, are there other people that could use this?
Some good tools there for people starting this process, maybe after this conversation. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Barbara McVicker, elder care expert, author, and creator of the public television special Stuck in the Middle, Caring for Mom and Dad. She was urging people as they age to go through their things, get rid of them, and consider it a gift to your kids, to the next generation.
And you can share your experiences if you've been through this process yourself, and maybe you've got advice for other listeners out there. Just head over to the Central Time Facebook page. You can share your story there. A shipping lock a little southwest of Chicago may become the new battleground in the effort to keep the Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. Meanwhile, scientists say they're getting better at tracking more of the invasive species that could be traveling between those lakes and the Mississippi River system. Chuck Quernbach is going to take us on a couple of mini-tours.
Near the city of Joliet, the Brandon Road Lock conveys barges and other small vessels around a dam in the Des Plaines River. A horn sounds at the Army Corps of Engineers operated lock as a barge and its tugboat prepare to enter a gate, moving upstream or toward Chicago. Over the next half hour, the downstream gates open, the barge carrying sand and other materials is maneuvered in, and eventually water bubbles in and the barge rises, rubbing against the lock walls. Eventually, the upstream gates open and the barge and tug are on its way. Jennifer Caddick of the Alliance for the Great Lakes says the Brandon Road Lock is another choke point where changes could be made to make it harder for invasive species to ride in with the barges and move between the Mississippi River and Great Lakes basins. Caddick says underwater electric barriers just 10 miles upstream at Romeoville, Illinois, are not fail-proof.
There are some scenarios where fish can, even when the barrier's on, can move through. So this is a great opportunity to add on a few additional layers as the region sorts out that longer-term permanent solution to this problem.
Caddick says a bill now in Congress could lead to water guns being installed below the lock to make it harder for Asian carp and other species to swim upstream, or sound could be added to deter the fish. It's also possible to flush clean water into the lock as the barge passes. And none of these wins the endorsement of American Waterways Operators, the barge and tugboat owners trade group. Vice President Lynn Munch says, sure, look at the Brandon Road lock, but...
How do you continue to move transportation through there effectively and efficiently during construction in such a limited space?
Munch says there's time to think about a solution because she contends the electric barriers and other controls have kept the carp in check. Munch also re-raises a red flag about some of the science of tracking Asian carp. She says relying too much on findings of the carp's DNA in water is a problem.
We have a lot of concerns with how the eDNA has been used because eDNA does not mean there's a fish there.
Not surprisingly, environmental DNA scientists defend the reliability of their findings.
This is our centrifuge that pushes the stuff we don't want down to the bottom of the tube.
At Notre Dame University, lab technician Krista Gantz describes part of the process for finding eDNA in water samples.
There are proteins and humic acids and things that weigh more, so we'll have that hopefully down at the bottom, and then we'll have our DNA and liquid at the top.
Professor David Lodge directs this lab and Notre Dame's Environmental Change Initiative. Lodge says the findings of carp eDNA almost always mean a live fish has been there, and not, for example, ridden in dead on a barge.
It's dead, it's going to be consumed and eaten, it's going to dilute. So it's possible, but it's not a very probable explanation for the repeated patterns in space and time of the detections of silver carp.
Lodge also says researchers are getting better at expanding the number of species whose DNA can be tracked in water and figuring the number of organisms that are there. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, after years of speculation, Hillary Clinton is expected to announce her presidential bid online this Sunday. We look at the timing of the announcement and how the campaign could unfold from here. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.